We're going to spend the next few minutes looking at the Global 2000 Report to the President, Entering the 21st Century. We're going to do it under the general rubric of a theological reading of Global 2000 and try to see if we can't suggest some ways that people of faith might read a document like this. And also then as a way of seeing how we might view events in our world. I remember when I was on internship now many long years ago in a northern suburb of Washington, D.C., Martin Marty came to be the Reformation speaker. I don't particularly remember what he preached on the Reformation Sunday, but the next day he met with the pastors and interns of the Washington area, and it was the day before the 1964 elections. And in that week prior to that, he cited four events that had happened. This, of course, was the election when Lyndon Johnson defeated Barry Goldwater. And in the week prior to that election, Khrushchev had been toppled from power. And Red China had detonated an atomic device, and I think it was the Macmillan government in Britain had been replaced. At least there was a replacement of the head of state or the head of the government in Britain, and Walter Jenkins, who was a White House assistant, had been arrested in a public restroom in Washington, D.C., soliciting a homosexual act. And Martin Marty said the thing that the church really clomped onto, and indeed the whole political arena in our country, was the last thing. His thesis was that we had done some kind of a job, at least, of teaching a kind of a sexual morality, particularly a personal one, but that in terms of relating our faith to the global issues, we didn't know how to relate to the other three. And I've been in trouble ever since that speech, trying to figure out what to do with all of that. And I'm not sure that I have any more answers now than... No, I think I have fewer answers. When I was an intern, I had answers to everything. And I've got at least one or two less answers now, although sometimes it doesn't seem that way. One of the themes that comes through often here at Holden, I think because, in my judgment at least, John Schramm has properly picked up something from John Taylor's book, Enough is Enough, that a great deal of our problem is not how we grasp, but how we see. And so as we look at the Global 2000 Report, I'm going to invite us to some new ways of seeing. The two theme books for this summer at Holden, both available in the bookstore, are a Holden reprint of some of the poems out of a book by James Carroll called Elements of Hope. And of course the other one, the other theme book, is the Global 2000 Report. And I'd like to read as kind of a frame, as kind of a seeing with, a think with, from one of James Carroll's little messages in free verse. I probably should translate because sometimes our memories aren't too good. He refers to some oil companies, and one of them is Humble, which no longer exists. It's now been its name changed to Exxon. And Exxon wouldn't work as well as Humble, but he did this before their name changed. The title of this little piece is The Lord's is the Earth. The Lord's is the earth and the fullness thereof, perhaps. I do know it's not mine. I wander out beyond the last outpost of our easy time together, past fields oozing corn, past a dead leaf curling, past a ditch of closed flowers, past a fox dragging his paw. I come to the last bare bough where last April a bird sang and I began my low humming. I cling to it again, and I know that this earth owns me. This branch is my master. How do we presume to claim for ourselves or for our children dirt that leaves labor over, or the low hill that is an ancient, broken-hearted mountain worn away by long erosion, white tides of snow? Who owns the rivers unseen that run in the bowels of the earth, that lubricate the turning of the axis of the world? Getty? Golf? Humble? Humble? When I was a child, dirt and dry leaves were my first friends. I sat with them, bouncing, talking, before I knew what playing was. I remember the summer day when the lady yelled at me, shoved me from her yard, from her dirt, from her dry leaves. Something wrong was done that day, but I thought I had done it. I ran away in my shame with fear that was new, having learned my first lesson in who really owns the earth. You can say the Lord's is the earth if you want to, but let him try to picnic where it is posted. Who owns the earth? Getty? Golf? Humble? Humble? And that mean lady of my early flight and shame? The firmament of stability, the foundation of the universe and source of all fertility, the womb, the tomb, the green planet. We learn to think of it as property or real estate if it's for sale. If we have awakened to the earth, we may be in trouble because it belongs to somebody else. We may use the sidewalk and the street and those scabs of concrete assigned to plane. If we exult in harvest now, we are trespassing. The mean lady this time may have a gun. If we allow the soil to stir our souls, we may be changed. We may learn what we once knew, that the dirt and dry leaves own us. It was men very like you and me who first cried, "The Lord's is the earth and the fullness thereof." They were probably trying to say more about each other than God. To say the land is the Lord's is not to say he is the landlord. The earth and its children know, the old men and women who own nothing, the defeated, the sharecroppers, the starving, the peasants who trespass everywhere. The Lord's is the earth, and it is full enough for everyone. It waits for us to learn again. I think that a theological reading of the Global 2000 report is an opportunity for us to learn again that the earth is the Lord's, and that it has been given to us to care for, and to tenderly care for. And there are some people in the village, particularly one of the staff members who has spent a year in graduate school looking at the Global 2000 report, who can go into the technical aspects of it much better than I can. I want to say a few things about what I'm going to share with you now in terms of what they are and what they are not. The Global 2000 report to the president was commissioned by Jimmy Carter on May the 23rd, 1977, in a message to the Congress. He proposed that it would be a one-year study in which the federal government, for the first time, would bring its people together who were already thinking about what policy changes and what kinds of effects the next 20 years would bring upon the earth. It was premised upon the fact that many of the problems that we face no longer know boundaries. They no longer know political jurisdictions. They are global in their scope. And the fact that many agencies in the federal government were doing planning based on policies that were contradictory to one another. And so this one-year study ended up taking 3 years. It was released in the summer of 1980 during the political campaign between Reagan and Carter. Carter made, to my knowledge, what I perceived anyway, he maybe made more remarks about it, but he did make one remark about it may well be that in the future we're all going to have to learn to live with less, with more scarcity. And of course, when the economy is stuck in low or neutral or reverse or whatever it's in, that didn't play well any place, let alone Peoria. And so the tenor of the whole campaign was, we've got to get the economy moving again, and in order to do that, we've got to release some things so that we can begin more and more to utilize our resources. And in my judgment, Reagan was simply more blatantly honest about that than, because Carter also, I think, succumbed to the same worldview. And it was not a worldview informed by the Global 2000 report, which he had commissioned. The Global 2000 report has all kinds of limitations. It is projections, not predictions. It simply says that if the following trends continue, this is what will happen. Lyle Schaller, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, wrote a book called The Impact of the Future, Trends Affecting the Church of Tomorrow, was the subtitle. And he starts out by showing what happens with projections. He said something to this effect, that in 1994 there will be no farmers left in America if present trends continue, because of the diminishing number of farms. And of course, you know that you reach a point at which other kinds of factors come in and take over. So that just shows the liability of projections. But projections are helpful to us to begin to understand what is going on in our present situation. And that if we don't, in fact, wake up to what's going on, these things will come close to happening, and many of them are highly destabilizing. And we'll talk about some of those that jump out at me, at least, and that I had never thought about as being problems that could be highly destabilizing in a world that is increasingly arming itself. The Global 2000 report says when it hooks itself up to other kinds of global models that have been done, which are more intentional in their linkages. In other words, when they really did their agricultural projections, one of the things they didn't worry much about was the fact that we were losing X number of acres per year to urban sprawl. And so when you start those kinds of linkages, they say that they could be 15% to 20% too optimistic. And the thing about the Global 2000 report, at least on one reading of it, is that it is very pessimistic. It does not paint a real happy picture for the year 2000. The year 2000, incidentally, is not, I think it's catchy, and I think that's the reason they chose it. It's 20 years down the road, it's the turn of the century, and so it provides something to hook on to and gives us some time frame to think about. They also make the point that many of the trends that are beginning now to emerge, that when they become really significant so that everyone is aware of them, it will probably be too late to change them. So that's all of the kind of news. When I did a little television piece on this for the Religious Broadcasting Commission in Seattle, I think it was in March or sometime, and we were going through all of this, and when they took time out for commercial break, why, the producer ran over and said, we've got to get more positive. The first situation that we always have in going through this is that we don't want to escape our situation. And so I would like to set another kind of a frame that I think is important for us as we read this thing theologically. I still think an extremely important book for people to work through is Douglas John Hall's Light in Our Darkness. And I would like to simply read one paragraph from this, because it's my rationale for giving you as much bad news as quickly as I can, and to invite you into this bad news. Let's be quite clear. Only the light is final. We have no lasting interest in the darkness as such, and certainly no desire to court it. It is necessary to think about it and to enter into it only because it is already there. It is already our condition, and the true light that lightens our darkness can only be apprehended by us as we stand honestly and knowingly exactly where we are. Indeed, the true light will itself lead us into our darkness, unlike the false lights of religions and worldviews. For it is known that only as we become accustomed to the night, the deepening gloom, are we able to see the light that is specifically light for this darkness. Otherwise, we are simply deluding ourselves with artificial light. And we simply don't want to grope, as Luther talked about, in the darkness of the Holy of Holies, feeling around to see where God is. That's very uncomfortable to us. But I think if we're going to live the politics of hope, we've got to see if we can't discover the difference between hope and optimism. And I'll make a personal confession at this point. I am an by nature optimist, and that makes faith and hope very hard for me, because if you're going around always figuring that something will turn up, that makes, you know, that's not a faith stance necessarily. So we'll see. Anyway, I'll read to you some of the stuff from the major findings and conclusions. And then we can spend some time visiting. If present trends continue, the world in 2000 will be more crowded, more polluted, less stable ecologically, and more vulnerable to disruption than the world we live in now. Serious stresses involving population, resources, and environment are clearly visible ahead. Despite greater material output, the world's people will be poorer in many ways than they are today. For hundreds of millions of the desperately poor, the outlook for food and other necessities of life will be no better. For many, it will be worse. Barring revolutionary advances in technology, life for most people on Earth will be more precarious in 2000 than it is now, unless the nations of the world act decisively to alter current trends. This, in essence, is the picture emerging from the U.S. government's projections of probable changes in world population, resources, and environment by the end of the century, as presented in the Global 2000 study. They do not predict what will occur, rather they depict conditions that are likely to develop if there are no changes in public policies, institutions, or rates of technological advance, or if there are no wars or other major disruptions. A keener awareness of the nature of the current trends, however, may indicate changes that will alter these changes or these trends and projected outcomes. Okay, just a few specifics on the situation. Principal findings. Rapid growth in world population will hardly have altered by 2000. The world's population will grow from 4 billion in 1975 to 6.35 billion in 2000, an increase of more than 50%. 90% of that increase will occur in the poorest countries. Okay. The population will increase from 4 billion in 1975 to 6.35 billion in the year 2000. 90% of that increase will come in the lesser developed nations. Mexico City will have a population of 30 million people in the year 2000.
Again, that's a projection.
Yeah, these are all projections, obviously, and some of the cities of the lesser developed nations, the population projections are incredible, and The next thing is in terms of the economies. While the economies of the less developed countries, LDCs, and I'll refer to them as that for shorthand, are expected to grow at faster rates than those of the industrialized nations, the gross national product per capita in most LDCs remains low. The average gross national product per capita is projected to rise substantially in some lesser developed nations, especially Latin America, but in the great populous nations of South Asia, it will remain below $200 a year in 1975 dollars. The large existing gap between the rich and poor nations widens in the next 20 years. World food production is projected to increase 90% over the 30 years from 1970 to the year 2000. This translates into a global per capita increase of less than 15% over the same period. Now listen, the bulk of that increase goes to countries that already have relatively high per capita food consumption. Meanwhile, per capita consumption in South Asia, the Middle East, and the lesser developed countries of Africa will scarcely improve or will actually decline below present inadequate levels. At the same time, real prices for food are expected to double. That's real prices that are adjusted for inflation. It will cost us twice as much money, even in inflated dollars, to eat in 2000 as it does today. In energy, we already know something about that. During the 1990s, world oil production will approach geological estimates of maximum production capacity, even with rapidly increasing petroleum prices. The study projects that the richer industrialized nations will be able to command enough oil and other commercial energy supplies to meet rising demands through 1990. With the expected price increases, many less developed countries will have increasing difficulty meeting energy needs. For the one quarter of humankind that depends primarily on wood for fuel, the outlook is bleak. Indeed, our needs for fuel wood will exceed available supplies by about 25% before the turn of the century. While the world's finite fuel resources, coal, oil, gas, oil shale, tar sands, and uranium, are theoretically sufficient for centuries, they are not evenly distributed. They pose difficult economic and environmental problems, and they vary greatly in their amenity to exploitation and use. Non-fuel mineral resources generally appear sufficient to meet projected demands through 2000, but further discoveries and investments will be needed to maintain reserves. In addition, production costs will increase with energy prices and may make some non-fuel mineral resources uneconomic. Now again, these are the kind of things we need to listen to with a theological ear. The quarter of the world's population that inhabits industrial countries will continue to absorb 3/4 of the world's mineral production. One quarter of us in the industrialized world, 3/4 of the world's non-mineral production. Then they talk about regional water resources. I'll just share one thing. There are of the world's 200 major river basins, 148 are shared by at least two countries. The other 52 are shared between 3 and 10 countries. And the increasing demands for fresh water by the year 2000, we will have outrun. The demand will have outrun the supply, and so that those shared river basins could be a highly destabilizing influence sometime in the next 20 years. And for those of us who live in Seattle, we know the big hassle that Seattle City Light and the government of British Columbia are already having over whether we can raise High Ross Dam. And California sits down there with their tongue out looking at the Columbia River. And that's just in this country. That's something that one does not think about very often is the rivers. And Iraq and Syria share the Euphrates, and the name now of the river that India and Bangladesh share, those are countries that are already in some tension with one another. Significant losses of world's forests will continue over the next 20 years as demand for forest products and fuel wood increases. Growing stocks of commercial-sized timber are projected to decline 50% per capita. The world's forests are now disappearing at the rate of 18 to 20 million hectares a year, an area half the size of California, with most of the loss occurring in the humid tropical forests of Africa, Asia, and South America. The projections indicate that by 2000, some 40% of the remaining forest cover in the lesser developed countries will be gone. Then we have the problem of turning our good soils into desertification. And we are losing enough soil now into that it becomes like desert, enough of that to cover the state of Maine every year. The Sierra Desert is creeping out
worldwide.
And we are having problems as the aquifers on our coasts, which took millions of years to fill up. When we pump them dry or pump them down faster than nature replaces them, what nature starts to replace them with is water that's much more saline in its composition. And so it may turn out to be finally not good for irrigation. A lot of good news here, right? Well, in the Sahel in Africa, and in northern India, see, it's interesting how we have an interconnectedness in the web of life. I think about this because it shows some of the irony of the situation. We have a daughter who a couple of years ago got her driver's license, and not only because I want to conserve a little bit, but also because I'm cheap. I've given her these lectures about how much she drives, and you know, you can use it now or you can use it later. That kind of thing. But anyway, one night I was bringing Stephen back from a basketball practice, and he wanted to stop by the 7-Eleven for a big gulp, and because it was cheaper there than to go to McDonald's to buy the Coke. And so as we were driving a few extra miles out of our way to save the thing, on one of the talk shows that just happened to be on the radio, they were talking about whether in the light of the fuel crisis and all of that, a person had the right to buy a muscle car, you know, one of those big Camaros or whatever that whenever you step on the gas, it's like flushing the toilet. And the conclusion of everybody who called in was, as long as they can afford it, they have a right to buy any kind of car you want. Now, I think a scene with a biblical perspective says no. And part of the reason, in terms of looking at the interconnectedness of things, as we, like the report I've already quoted from, says that the industrialized nations will be able to command fossil fuels well into the 90s. We can go into the world market and buy this stuff. That means that the lesser developed nations who had been using fossil fuels for heating and cooking can no longer do that. So they turn increasingly to fuel wood, to trees. And in some places in northern India and in the Sahel, right now it takes 360 person days a year to collect enough firewood to take care of the heating and cooking needs of a family. That means one person gets 5 days off a year of collecting firewood. And in some places in the urban centers, they're already as much as 50 kilometers out from the urban areas in getting to where they can get that kind of wood. As they can less and less afford fossil fuels, they're going to have to turn to that more and more. So the more we burn, the more we force them into fossil or into wood fuels.
He was astounded when they filled up with gas that it took $120 American dollars just to fill the tank. That has a bad economy, you know, but that's what fossil fuels were costing them.
Okay, and then as they use more and more of this, take off more and more of this forest cover, what happens then, first of all, is that no longer does the land hold the moisture that comes. So you erode the soil away, the soil becomes less productive. Then as you have less and less fuel woods, and this is true particularly in northern India, the people there turn then to burning animal dung and vegetable waste. Now where were they putting that before? Onto the soil, which grew the crops.
So there's a lot of reforestation going on?
In the industrialized nations, yes. We are not losing forest lands appreciably in the industrialized nations. Again, what we said at the very outset of reading this is the gap between rich and poor is going to widen, and that's part of the reason for that. Now, just a couple more things. Atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide and ozone-depleting chemicals are expected to increase at rates that could alter the world's climate and upper atmosphere significantly by the year 2050. They jumped at 50 years there. There is a lot of debate about that, but that's at least a possibility. Acid rain from increased combustion of fossil fuels, especially coal, threatens damage to lakes, soils, and crops. And you already know in the northern tier states in this country that have granite-based lakes, that the acidity of those lakes is such that in many of them fish will no longer grow. The ones that have limestone bases are still okay because the limestone is neutralizing the acid rains that fall. But even in the Holy Land of Norway, there are many lakes that no longer support fish life. And that's, the winds are west-east, so they're getting our stuff. And also we know there's tensions between the United States and Canada over them getting our stuff. I read an article, and this is one of the things that after you've gone through Global 2000, you begin to read Time magazine differently. And a lot of, like, they had an article in there about the fact that even though the United States produces only 30% of the material that produces acid rain, do you hear those words, that it produces only 30% of the world's, you know, whatever produces this acid rain? And then you remember that we're 6% of the world's population, and you begin to see that, wait a minute, only a third of all that's produced in the world can we claim. I mean, that I think you start to see things a little differently when one is invited into this. Then extinction of plant and animal species will increase dramatically. Hundreds of thousands of species, perhaps as many as 20% of all species on Earth, will be irretrievably lost as their habitats vanish, especially in tropical forests. And I think of the Genesis text about the creation of the birds of the air and the creatures that swim in the ocean, and the psalm that talks about the fact that God made the Leviathan for the sport of it. Just a beautiful imagery. I mean, if nobody else is enjoying them, evidently God is. And, you know, just to think about what the loss of those species means. We could go on and on in this, you know, spreading this kind of gloom. The purpose in looking at this, as I indicated at the beginning, was to begin to ask ourselves, how would we view this material as people of faith? What would be our response as faith people? And I'm not going. I've got an agenda about that, but let's just visit for a little bit about what our responses to this kind of stuff might be. And what I'd like to set aside for a moment right now is a technical argument with the material, because there are technical arguments with it, and that goes without saying. It's got big gaps in it. It's not as like some people were here earlier a couple of weeks ago who are demographers, and one of the things that they don't have the foggiest about is some of the population of some nations. Russia does not disclose that information, and so there's lots of problems with that. But nonetheless, when this is compared to other world studies, you know, they vary in degrees, but not much in trends. So let's stay away from that discussion, and let's ask ourselves how we as people of faith respond to this. Okay? Anybody want to try something?
I'm struck with the fact that apparently there was a long time in history when humans felt in a way at the mercy of nature. There was an awe there. But at least for a few centuries, there's been a very different attitude and a different metaphor used, almost a rape metaphor, that sort of says, this earth is here for me to win over, to get hold of it somehow, either scientifically and technologically, to sort of beat it into shape for me, to pull stuff out of it for me, it's for me, I put it there. And I think there's a growing awareness now of how destructive this has been, and at least among many people, a moving toward a personal metaphor, an idea of a relationship with a very dynamic, spirited cosmos in which I have a relationship, a loving, caring relationship with all that there is. And it's very personal. It feeds me, it nurtures me. I must, with my particularly psychoed intelligence as a human, care for it. And we're together, we really are.
Douglas John Hall, in this book, suggested that our problem is how, you know, the Imago Dei, what does it mean that humankind is created in the image of God? And he says that our understanding of the image of mankind went awry, and that the biblical tradition teaches two strands. One is the strand in which we are the underlords. We are given to have this dominion and caring, but the other part of it is our fallenness. And he says in the Renaissance we lost the fallenness aspect of it, and he has a slogan is, man, and that's generic man, is neither good enough nor wise enough to be master. And so he calls for a new image of what it means to be human. That's really valuable insight in this book, but it relates exactly, I think, to what you're saying. Lighten our darkness. There is the expert that studied the technical stuff on the Global 2000, but you see, I took him out of this part of the discussion by saying that's off limits. But Jeff Townsend up here can give you some specifics, and so if you have questions like that, I'll refer them to Jeff. So.
Who's the doctor?
Douglas John Hall, who's at McGill University in Montreal.
We're facing a shortage right here at home, and it's real, and it'll be before the year 2000. That's water. In the old West, water rights were fought out with rifles. Today, where's water shortage, there's politics. And June 8th, the peripheral canal vote by the residents of California, which prevented the plan, which would have been a 43-mile, more or less, very wide aqueduct running from the Sacramento River and the San Joaquin Delta around and down to tap into a tremendous aqueduct going down to Southern California. And now that it hasn't, that it was defeated, the Southern California interests, of course, are looking longingly at diverting part of Columbia River down there. This has been going on for about 20 years. In 1968, we were saved when Scoop Jackson, the senator from Washington, got a motion or a vote in the Senate that prevented any funding for a study on this diversion. And that lasted for 10 years. And in 1978, Mark Hatfield of Oregon and Jackson had it extended for another 10 years. That means in 1985, this will come to a head. But with the defeat of the peripheral canal, Southern California is going to be hurt even sooner, because in 1985, the portion of the Colorado River allocated to Arizona, which has never been given to them, will be made available to Arizona by the completion of an aqueduct from the Colorado River at 7.5 million acre feet per year, which will be taken away from Southern California. The result is that the funds that were spent by Northern and Southern California in this June 8th vote, we're into the millions of dollars. And of course, the aqueduct or the peripheral canal would have cost into the billions. But Southern California had been shafted by the lack of water from the Colorado since, in 1922, the Colorado River Compact, approved by the Congress, measured the availability of water at the highest level of any year up to then and since then. And the problem is real, and we're going to be faced with defending our water rights and having to decide what we do about this, because Southern California interests, and they're not only powerful in Washington, but there's an awful lot of money down there being used for this, and the catalyst is, of course, the Los Angeles Municipal Water Board, which serves not only their own area, but San Diego. San Diego gets all of its water from the Colorado. LA gets 3/4. They're going to lose some of that by 1985. So when you talk about shortages, we've got it right here at home.
All right. Someone had a hand up over here. Okay. And
so another horror story about your farmer in northern Minnesota who said that maybe you could advise me what to do in order to feed my kids. My farming, I have to poison the land, so it's probably it won't grow food for my grandchildren because it's poison.
Yeah, one of the neighbors that we need to learn to care about is our child or grandchild. And we have never, one of the things we've lost in our perspective, I think, is that the neighbors for whom we are to care will be our descendants. To ask for perspective. So far, But what will people, you know, to press the question that I want to press, what is a faith response to all of this? What do we do? Hope something turns up or what? How do we have hope in this situation? What is our hope? How do we read this faithfully? Jeff?
Well, a number of these points that were brought up are very interesting as far as caring for each other's and for our descendants, communicating between states, communicating between countries. As a faith response, I try to become better aware of the issues involved. From there, take it a step farther and act on it. The worldly aspects of the facts that present themselves in the reality of the world. Just a lot of thoughts going in my head of a lot of what was said from the floor, that some of the answers, particularly in, I'm a Southern Californian, and so I'm affected by the water resources issues down there. And it comes to a point that really bothers me of why we need to grab this water. And it seems that undergirding all of this is very poor land use practices of expanding populations in areas that do not self-support the populations as they can. Whether it's Southern California or Arizona, where they draw the groundwater for both irrigation and for drinking purposes. On the one hand, say, Washingtonians can express their feelings toward others and say, yeah, our Christian response would be, okay, let them have the water, we've got plenty of it. And yet on the other hand, I think everyone can say, well, let's fix up the problems of the high density population so this problem isn't self-perpetuating.
Okay. My response is sadness. You know, to all this, because I can't imagine having children and not having enough food to feed them, to watch them be hungry. You know, fear as to at some point all these countries seeing that it doesn't have to be that way, or that there are so many richer countries taking so much more than they deserve, and then guilt that. You know, I can use, if there is so much to use that I don't need any. We live in an area where we don't get very good reception to do and watch media news. And it's helpful in that way to be a better news to their side of things, especially the draft in issue. And they speak to that through letters. I guess that would be my only response. But that, first of all, just the parents, just to take this issue, you know, not so much the Southern California people are vague, but it's us.
Okay. Good.
I think, Charles, something that comes to mind for me for the last couple of years, I've been involved with babies in the house and on and on and on. Somebody else has the expertise there, more articulate than I am and more capable. And I think that when I listen to stuff like this, it is really showing me how political that decision that I have made, that someone else can do it. And that I think I find for myself now that I have to be more aware of what's going on, and I have to stop and voice my opinion. Share those opinions, maybe with political people, or my political decision on how much gas I use, or the et cetera, et
Okay, thank you. Anyone else?
Well, I think maybe carrying on from that, we have given the power to others in some manner, either the experts, the scientists, the politicians, whoever. We've also given them a set of expectations. You know, maybe subtle and maybe informal, but they're there. You know, like, we don't want to wait the gas line. We don't want to use up all the fuel, we've got to conserve it, but we don't want to wait the gas line. You know, we used to say that for various other groups, reactions in newspapers, whatever it might be. I guess where I see it, I think in my mind, it's particularly apparent right now, is our general American industry. You know, the people who bought stocks in the industries, they come back and they say, well, we expect a certain amount of return, so the dividends come in, and the dividends probably should be going back into the company to build. And that's why we can buy steel in Japan cheaper than we can produce it here. You know, because we're not looking ahead, nor our short-sightedness allows us to look through the next quarter. And we're clearly doing that with the environment. So, yeah, as we turn these things over to the experts, you know, we really have to examine the expectations we're also carrying and giving away.
All right, Evelyn, and then I'll go up here.
Yeah, I really think that we are... faith in action does mean political action. I think here's where our values have to come into play. This whole business of water use, for example, and another aspect, since some of you mentioned the Colorado River, would be the what are the priorities when it came to the oil shale thing. I mean, because if the oil shale development had gone on and projected, now one big company backed out, but it may still go on. Then very little of that water would have gone either to California or Arizona because it would have all gone to the oil shale development. I mean, you can't have it all. So I think we as Christians can express some priorities, some values in terms of water for agriculture is more important perhaps than more energy to burn up in some way that is not so important. But if we're going to be political, I think we recognize very often that there's a lot of frustration. And we get to the point, you know, we write letter after letter, and your congressperson says, thank you for your letter, but I don't agree with you, or something a little kinder and so on. And I think we need to remember, again, on the theological basis, that God doesn't call us to be successful. We're only called to be responsible. And when you think about many of the prophets, I mean, boy, they got no response that they saw in their lifetime. And I think we need to remember that if we are political, I mean, we get so frustrated. And just finally say, what use is it? I'm not making anything. God doesn't ask us to be successful. Just responsible and faithful.
Okay. All right.
I'm thinking about is there's probably a set of two different levels of what we can do. There's some easy things that are helpful that we should do. Some other things that are hard. I think that relatively easy things to do are to care for the earth on a personal level, to conserve, to recycle. I think a lot of us have done some of that. And I think it can be done, easily done, and sometimes we wonder if it's really helping. But I think it can help. When I was in San Francisco a few years ago, there was a shortage of water, temporary, and they asked people to voluntarily use less water. In 1 year, the use of water around San Francisco dropped 15% just because people decided to use a little less water. And that's a big drop when there's a relatively minimal force causing people to use less water. They just voluntarily use that much less. And so I think we can make a big impact just by trying to be a little more careful, and that we need to and have to do that. But there's a whole, and there's another set of things that for the United States, using fossil fuels, I think to conserve some can come relatively easily because there are, as prices go up, we naturally use less, and there are forces that coincide that make conserving work. But then there's another whole set of things that there aren't any real easy answers for, the things that you said that while the prices go up that we can still afford, the third world nations are forced to use fuels that are, you know, wood fuel and things like that, where forces aren't going in the right direction, that don't add up properly. And those are the real tough questions. They're sort of system questions. They're
that the economic system doesn't automatically give us the answers. Sometimes it does, but there are other systemic, you know, problems where those answers don't seem to be happening. And those are the ones that, in the end, somehow we have to solve, and it's not easily apparent how.
Oh, got it.
The dilemma I get into is that I get impatient, and I want to do something now, and then I reflect on the problem with our whole society is that the whole society has been impatient. We want to claim everything for ourselves now, and somehow the marketer Christian has to deal with that whole attitude of being patient, you know, what's right in the long run, and that's such a difficult struggle for me. You know, how much should I, I guess just what direction am I going in the long run? Because I want to make these radical whatevers in the here and now. And then I find myself saying that's what the whole technological agony has gotten us into, is making the rash decisions. And I want to be rash too. I find myself being society when I do that.
Okay.
Part of what I want to participate in as an agenda for a Christian is some kind of a redemption of the concept of authority and dominance. I think we have a tendency to say authority and dominance or caring, you know, as though these were antithetical somehow or other. And I think for the Christian, there is a way of making these both operate together in a new sense, in a redeemed sense, that any opportunity I have for dominance over another younger, smaller, weaker human, or the earth itself, is an opportunity to have special rights of exploitation. And I think it's mostly been considered that way, especially by the Western world, and this has implications, of course, for male-female relationships, too. But if instead the opportunity for superior influence is thought of as a superior responsibility for caring, nurturing, for being near to that other person in need, or that earth in its need for replenishing, it begins to take on a different feel. We begin to act differently. We get different rewards from it. That's very important to support that kind of thing.
Okay, Mike?
Just something I've been aware of in local city land use environmental issues is the small number of people that are really, you know, making these decisions and influencing city officials, in our case, and county officials. And you know, how they listen to those people who really take the time to take issue with what's happening. And it's really amazing how small a number of people there are in that region.
Right. So. And it's like, I guess Jenny said earlier, it's because we abdicated. I mean, we just said somebody who knows better, you know.
It seems to me that the report is a report around scarcity, and that scarcity, you know, is fearful. And I don't want to minimize that or seem to wipe it away by the next statement. But I think the remembrance we have to have is our God of abundance, and the things in which He is able to give us that are abundant. And beyond that, I don't, you know, it's just that I don't want to think of God as a God of scarcity. We have created scarcity.
Okay, one comment and then we'll...
I'd like to pick up on that, because I think through the eyes of faith, one continues to be terribly hopeless about man and terribly hopeful about God. Somehow or another, we've got to struggle and keep this tension. A few years ago at our college, we had Charles Malik as our speaker, the Christian statesman from Lebanon, on the subject, world starvation disaster of the 70s. And he spent two lectures really painting the picture of how dire things are, along the same tenor as this particular report. And then toward the end of his third lecture, he said, "But I am a child of God, and I put my trust in Him. This is His world. We are His people." And right about that time, several people got up and walked out. I mean, they didn't want that injected in there. That was being unrealistic. But he brought the whole matter of hope into focus against this terrible background for which there didn't seem to be any solution, except that as a Christian, he also saw that God could work in some marvelous ways to address some of these problems. As, for example, the tremendous resources for food in the ocean, or even the possibility of irrigating the Sahara. I mean, he was still willing to think in those hopeful terms, in spite of the fact that he did not in any way gloss over the tragedy of world starvation. And I think the outcome of that is that we are on the side of the God of hope, who must then deal with these hopeless situations as best we can, because we represent Him in this human dilemma.
The difficulty that I see us in is that several things. When I read this report, I think the first thing that we have to see is that basically I am the problem, that I participate in a society that consumes way too much, and that if God is a God of hope for all the children of the world, we will be changed. And I went through a doctorate ministry program trying to figure out, can you move toward a theology of enough in suburbia? And if I'm any example of that, we are in big trouble. And so when I hope that God writes things, my hope is going to be really different than the fact that like when I use that television thing again afterwards, the guy said, "Well, you know, it's like, with this equipment we have here now, it used to take up two or three times as much electricity as it does now. So we're making progress. But it's progress so we can still live up here while everybody else lives down here." I'm not sure that's going to go on. It's like a friend of mine uses this illustration. Suppose you are a parent. You have 10 children around your table. You pass the food. The first person takes 30% of it. And by the time you pass the third person, there's hardly anything left. How long are you going to let your children eat like that? That, I think, is the beginning of hope. But boy, that's not the hope I want. And I'll be really honest with you, that is not the hope I want. I want something to turn up. And the cross, you know, the problem with this strange God of ours is that when He wants to give us life, He kills us first. And I want to escape all those little incidences before we get to that hope. And so anyway, I invite you, one of the fun things I've thought about as I read through this, and I've never done it in margins of mine, but I would love sometime to go through this and write in little biblical references on the sides of this, of what biblical images this stuff raises in my mind. Last thing I'll say about this little thing that I referred to is the summary volume of Global 2000. There's a large technical volume, which is the second one, which, if you want to get into the technical aspects of it, is you know, I can hardly read the thing, even though it's in non-technical language, Jeff tells me. And then the third one is hopelessly beyond me because it's the computer models they use. But I really recommend that this is in the bookstore. One of the things that has happened since Jimmy went out of office and Ronnie got in is this went from 350 to 425. I don't know that has anything to do with it, but... Another book that I haven't heard a lot about discussed, but I found extremely helpful, was written by a University of California at Davis or someplace, a guy by the name of W. Jackson Davis, entitled The Seventh Year. And it's a written from a scientific point of view about the problems we face, and it's delightful book. For as gloomy, he does not come out in the end totally gloomy. He says our society will change. But the thing that we found interesting in my group, and this is the last thing I'll say, is that the people who went through the Depression were able to have a memory about some community values that they themselves left as they got sucked into our materialistic acquisitive society. So it may be when we have less, we'll have more. I mean, that may be the hope of it all. Anyway, let's go eat.